confidential drop-in peer support sessions with trained volunteers. Our goal is to lend a listening ear and empower you to continue to strive towards wellness. Our services are available Monday to Friday, 9 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. and 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. during exam season. Support sessions can be requested at our desk on the main floor of the Nest or by ringing the doorbell outside our private space in room 3121. Learn more by visiting the AMS Speakeasy website. No issue is too big or too small. We're here to listen.
And welcome to Unceded Airways. We are broadcasting live from CITR 101.9 on unceded Musqueam territories. My name is Thalia Joseph. I'm from Squamish and Nanaimo Nations.
Hi, I'm Samantha Nock. I'm Métis from our communities in Isle of Cross. I'm from Northeast BC, Treaty 8 territory.
So this episode is called Love Medicine, and we will be chatting about the implications of dating as Indigenous women. I don't know what that sound was.
I don't know either.
Then we're also going to be talking about some current events. So, Sam, do you want to let them know what we'll be chatting about?
We're going to be talking about the recent Supreme Court decision called the Daniels decision, which granted the terminology around this is touchy. And I feel like I'm walking through a minefield right now. But basically, granted the same status as status Indians to Métis and non-status people. So we are in now a federal relationship with Justin Trudeau.
What does that mean? If you don't know, we will get there. And we don't really know either.
I'm not sure, and I'm Métis. and then after that, we're going to be talking about the suicide crisis in Attawapiskat and a little more about the conversations that are going on around that.
Yeah, and how it's been framed and how we might be able to take full advantage of our position here, having these airwaves to talk about how we might be able to dissect how the mainstream media frames it and how mm-hmm. we might be able to think about it from a more critical media perspective.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, normally on the show, we exclusively play music by Indigenous authors, artists. But because today is the
love episode,
the love and dating episode, we have a special guest for on the show for you. So, without further ado, we're going to play a song, and then we'll come back. Please enjoy.
Thank you very much, and everybody's waiting for you to sing, so what's it going to be?
My brand new Decca record.
Crazy Gal, crazy.
Crazy, I'm crazy for feeling so lonely. I'm crazy. Crazy for feeling so blue. I knew you'd love me as long as you wanted, and then someday you'd leave me for somebody new. Wondering for thinking that my love could hold you. I'm crazy for trying and crazy for crying, and I'm crazy for loving you. Crazy for thinking that my love could hold you. I'm crazy for crying and crazy for trying, and I'm crazy for loving you.
Interested in human rights and social justice? Come check out Amnesty International UBC. We fight to stop human rights violations all over the world, including here in Canada. Our club hosts letter writing sessions, social events, documentary nights, bar fundraisers, and current events discussions on a bi-weekly basis. So keep your ears open and check out our Amnesty International UBC Facebook page for more information. We look forward to promoting human rights with you.
Hey there.
Hello, and welcome back to Unceded Airwaves. You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM. We want to again hold our hands up to our Musqueam hosts, for whose traditional and ancestral territory we are broadcasting from today, and thank them for allowing, well, just acknowledge them for being on their territory.
Yeah. And so you heard Crazy by Patsy Cline, who is our exception to our Indigenous artists only rule. Because if we're going to be having an episode about Indigenous dating and Indigenous love, our girl Patsy has to be there for us. So,
yeah, the other day I went to a Patsy Cline cover show in Victoria.
Isn't that like 4 months ago?
Sam, that's still relevant. And most of the audience was Native. It was like a really hip venue, and there were all these like old Native grandmas there. It was really cute. So it is an anthem
Some
of us.
All of us.
So, the reason we wanted to do this episode is because there have been some articles published throughout the year around the politics of Native dating, and we thought we would bring in our own two cents.
Mm-hmm. So, I think there was one published in the last couple of years by Lisa Charlie Boy on CBC. I think before we begin, though, I want to just preface this by saying that there's no right or wrong mm-hmm. way to date as an Indigenous person. Mm-hmm. And our sexualities and our love lives have been dictated by colonization and settler ideals and all those things for a very long time. And so this episode isn't about what is a right way or a wrong way to date as an Indigenous person. We're just going to be talking about some of the politics of Indigenous dating and hopefully laughing along the way.
Yeah, for sure. And also talking about complicating these tropes around Native women and their sexuality as being kind of hypersexual, right? And animalistic.
Yeah.
And that talking about the right for Native women who carry this burden of representation to feel sexy, to feel wanted, and to have like a subjective sexual desire that is validated mm-hmm. and isn't just this sort of promiscuous, framed desire.
Yeah, and also the complete erasure of Two-Spirit and queer Indigenous sexuality and love that happens quite often through that same vein. But going back to what we were talking about before, in the last couple years, I'm not 100% sure when it was published, Lisa Charlieboy, who is a fantastic person, she did an awesome CBC radio show last summer.
Yeah.
And runs Urban Native Meg, and before that was Urban Native Girl. She had a great blog. She published this article, a very honest article, about how she only wants to date status men.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting.
Was it just status or just Indigenous men?
Status men specifically.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, and so then, like, of course, the internet trolls erupted because this idea that that Native women would want to be with Native men in the first place is, like, this sort of, this idea that you're going beneath you, right?
Yeah, there's this, like, idea that you're going beneath you, that, you know, you're somehow racist or prejudiced against white men or non-Native men because you only want to date Native and specifically only want to date status, when really there's more to the argument or more to the conversation than that. So basically in the article, Lisa was talking about how dating status for her makes sense as another status person because then she can legally pass down her status to her children. And so for those who don't know, Indian status is very tightly regulated, and depending on what type of status you have, so brace yourselves, there's different types of Indian status, you can't pass it down to your children if you're a woman, so, or a man if you have 6'2 status, but basically there's a cutoff, and it's ridiculous. So depending
on when you got your status.
And when you got your status, yeah. And so she was saying that she would want to date a status man so she has the chance to pass down her status onto her children.
So that her children can have access to band membership, to her land, to live on her land. It's this tricky kind of double-edged sword where the Indian Act is this incredibly racist legislation. It's racist, sexual, like sexist, but it is one of the only things tying people to land or giving any kind of recognition.
Yeah.
To use that challenging word.
Yeah. Well, it's like, it's one of those things where, like, I mean, obviously it's kind of a very glaringly obvious thing where, like, you don't have to have status to, like, have a connection to community and land. But along with Indian status comes, like, a specific fiduciary relationship with the federal government. It has access to certain things and, you know, like, certain, like, agreements in your treaty if you are covered by a treaty. And so, and, like, access to reserve lands and stuff like that. And so the chance of not passing that on to your children is stressful, and literally no one else has to worry about this.
But, like, then the other side of this discussion is how many people, particularly women, have lost their status because of the Indian Act and through other, like, racist, sexist, heteropatriarchal legislations from the state. And so I have friends who are non-status and friends that are status who have done a lot of work around thinking beyond the status card, thinking beyond a state relationship that that seemingly legitimizes your identity as an Indigenous person. So what does it then mean to think about community that way and to think beyond this little laminated piece of paper that gets to determine your status? And it's so strange because my mother married my father before the amendments, or when did she marry him? Basically, she married him before the Indian Act legislations, wherein if Native men married non-Native women, then the Native women, or then the non-Native women would get status, and if Native women married non-Native men, they would lose their status. And so my mom got status as a white woman, and so thus I have full status, but I'm half Indigenous. And then I have cousins who have like second tier status. So it's so confusing, and the implications are totally nonsensical.
Yeah, it's very confusing. And me, as a Métis person, I don't have Indian status. I have a different relationship to the government, which recently just turned federal. It used to only be provincial, but that's something we'll talk about later. But for me, how my citizenship, so people can call it Métis status or Métis citizenship. It kind of differs on which conversation you're having. I say citizenship. So I have my Métis citizenship with the Métis Nation of British Columbia. Even though we're from Saskatchewan, like, our community's in Saskatchewan, we had to register in BC because my family's lived here for a while. It's very confusing. And so our status or our citizenship is passed down through having to prove our lineage. So when you want to go and register for your Métis card, you have to prove that you have ties back to the historical Métis settlements in Red River.
Which we will get to later when we'll talk about the Daniels decision.
Way later. But this is just a preface for what I'm going to say next is, so me, I don't really have to worry about not being able to pass down my citizenship or my connections or whatever you want to call it to my children, because I know my children will be able to trace their lineage back through me and my family. And so it's different. But we also don't have the same relationship with the federal government that First Nations or Status Indian folks had, where like it was very strictly regimented through the Indian Act as a ways of elimination. I mean, we were regimented and eliminated through our own ways, and that's kind of why we're covered through the provincial government, which is a whole new conversation. But I'm not going to say it's less stressful for Métis dating, but...
just different.
It's different, yeah.
But then it's different in terms of your relationship to the state and accessing resources. But then it brings us to this whole other question about cultural competency. And so what does it mean to, for me, to be Native and then to be with somebody who might not understand that part of me? Mm-hmm. And for me, unlike where maybe where Lisa was coming from, at least right now in my life, who knows? Mm-hmm. But for me, it's come down to a necessity for the person that I'm with to be able to get it, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't think having to like get it necessarily comes with being Indigenous.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not undermining Lisa's article because I get it, that too.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the whole thing about this show is like there's so many different perspectives on this issue and it's important stuff to talk about. And I would never judge someone who only dates Native people.
No, never. I would never judge somebody because I totally get it.
Mm-hmm.
Totally get it. I also just want to say that just because we're talking about status and citizenship, that's not necessarily like the only connection to Indigeneity. I'm just talking about it in the ways that
it's been used strategically.
It's been used strategically. But there's also
for survival. Not even strategy somehow seems like a calculated thing, but it's around survival as well.
And just like to give everybody listening just like a taste of how complicated this is. Like even as a Métis person, if I were to marry somebody whose status, what would we register our kids as? Because you legally, both within our nations and in the eyes of the government, can't claim status. So we couldn't say our kids were status and Métis. They couldn't claim citizenship to both.
Really?
Yeah, you can't. So you can have one or the other, right?
Hmm.
That's because like it's based on very like...
Something tells me you'll win this fight, Sam. I'm not trying to cross her.
So like it's ridiculous. And I just don't know anybody else who like when they sit down to like... bone, it's just like, so
let's
what's
talk about
your
this.
Relationship to the federal government?
Yeah.
Like in case I have a baby, I just like need to know. And also what are your like your last names,
because yeah.
Mama
whole,
also needs to know we're not
that's
cousins.
A whole other conversation. Oh my gosh, yeah, needing to move somewhere else in the country to start to date.
I fully don't date Métis men from Saskatchewan. Just because I'm so scared because my family name is Morin.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm in a relationship, so this is kind of an aside anyways, but some at Inspire Native Awards ceremony, some person came up to me and was like, oh, like, can I buy you a drink? And I was like, oh, like in a relationship being like, how do I approach this one? And I was like, oh, yeah, like, what's your name? And he's like, La 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 Baker. I'm like, oh, I'm a Joseph. And just kind of looked at each other, walked away. You know, like it's just these like, hilarious exchanges, like not gonna happen where we've got the same great great grandmother.
Oh man, that actually recently happened to a friend of mine who was talking to someone on Tinder and realized that they are related.
Yep,
they're
classic.
Yep, and
classic
Métis from Manitoba.
The struggle
is so real. And there's like no gentle way to approach that when you're like chatting up someone. There's no just people like, so hey, how are you? Blah, 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 blah. Can I buy you a drink? What's your family tree? Like,
yeah.
There's no, and you just really hope you don't find out down the road.
Yeah.
When your cookum's like, what the fuck?
Yeah. And I also think it's interesting to think about what community membership and community involvement looks like beyond status, and so, and also beyond race. And so thinking about our, like, more traditional community structures, what it meant to bring somebody into your community and have those relationships moving forward. So, like, my mom and dad met when they were really young, and they were married for, like, 20 years. And my mom became an active member of that community. And she's not claiming that she's Indigenous, right? She's not taking up that kind of space. But what does it mean to walk really thoughtfully in a community and contribute as a community member, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and I think that that kind of work is what it is, what real relations are made of.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, my my auntie's partner, like, one of our matriarchs in our family, one of my dad's youngest sisters, she's been with a non-Native man for, 20 years, and they've lived up on the Squamish Reserve their whole relationship, and he is an active member of that community. He knows everybody. He's always there. He's always participating in ceremony and helping out our aunties in the most active ways. And
I love that.
I know, just at their beck and call. And to me, that's what it's all about. And yeah, that goes beyond things. But that's for me. I also understand people that are like, I simply cannot relate to somebody who can't speak to my experiences.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot relate to somebody who didn't grow up on the reserve like I did, or who doesn't know these songs like I know, or who doesn't know how to honor me this certain way. Like, I get mm-hmm. that too.
I totally understand that. I personally don't only date Native. And really what I just look for in someone is someone who does have that level of respect. And, like, I totally get it when, especially I've noticed with, here we go, with white men, is that,
dun, dun, dun.
Dun, 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 I said it, here we go, cat's out of the bag, is that there is just, like, I don't know, like, a not, like, a place, I always feel like you have to teach, like, I feel like I always have to, like, teach and, like, lead someone along to be like, hey, this is my reality as an Indigenous woman,
mm-hmm.
and come along for the ride. Mm-hmm. And you better be respectful because I got some scary aunties. But you just, like, yeah, it's just obviously this all exists. Like, our love exists outside of legislation, outside of status, outside of all of this all of these politics. But when it comes down to this, like, how do you move forward?
Mm-hmm.
How do you have, like, healthy,
mm-hmm.
functioning, good, wholesome, I was about to say wholesome relationships with someone when you carry this all with you, and you carry all these politics, you
mm-hmm.
carry colonial trauma, you do all this,
mm-hmm.
and you still have to somehow have, like, a fairly normal relationship
yeah.
with someone.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, like, dating somebody who's non-Native, there are going to be implications. There are going to be things that you will not be able to relate to, right? And so, not assuming that non-Native is white, and assuming, like, whatever
yeah, yeah.
race, whatever culture you're coming from, there are going to be things that you can't quite understand in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just something that you need to be willing to negotiate. And also, just like you said, all of these traumas that we carry, dating Native means that likely your partner carries them too.
Yeah, one of the most difficult relationships I've ever had was with another Indigenous person, and it was a mess. And just because we both had traumas we never dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you're, like, you think it's going to be, like, easier. You think, like, when you're with somebody, it's going to be, like, okay. Like, you know, you're going to, like, start off on the same, like, step. But really, it's, like, you have so much to deal with,
mm-hmm.
and then you both are kind of just like,
mm-hmm.
maybe, like, I'm not ready
to love
someone.
At least in that,
like,
scenario,
yeah.
and that's not
yeah.
always how it is.
No,
right?
No, not always, no.
And it just depends, and it's all so circumstantial, and it's also so personal, but there are themes that kind of fit across the board.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely complicated.
It's very complicated.
So, on that note, we are going to give you a song to mull over the intricacies of what we just talked about.
Stand up, live strong, no way dictate.
Hello, and welcome back to Unseated Airwaves. You are listening to CITR 101.9. Sam, do you want to tell us who we were just listening to?
I guess. We just heard One Better by Iskwe, and before that we heard Well, Well, Well by Ghost Keeper from Calgary.
Both Indigenous, both can be found on the CBC's top 10
Indigenous musicians you gotta listen to.
Yeah, so it's all on their website if you want to check them out.
And neither were Patsy Cline, which I was wanting to do an entire show with Patsy Cline, but that's fine.
Yeah, we were planning the show out in the lobby of CITR, just belting Patsy Cline, because no one else is in the station.
Yeah, no one's in the station besides this one person walked in, and then we realized we were just sitting there listening to Patsy Cline, and, well, you gotta do what you gotta
Maybe
do.
Maybe we're the reason no one else is in the station. That's possible. So if you are just tuning in, we've been chatting about dating as Indigenous women.
Dun, dun, dun.
And the politics behind that whole process. And so we're gonna pick up where we left off. And there were a couple more aspects of the politics of dating that we wanted to get into. So in the beginning of the episode, we mentioned that we were going to talk about the right to feel sexy and be sexy as Native women.
Yeah, Indigenous women's sexuality is, like, so regulated. It's ridiculous. Like, you're constantly put on the spectrum where if you're, like, you're too sexy. And I mean, this is obviously something that a lot of women face. But it's specific for Indigenous women and is felt in a little bit of a different way because of how our bodies have been policed since colonization and how we've been written about in stories and movies, how we're portrayed in media, like news, like, you know, like everything is really greatly regulated for us. And so, you know, you're constantly on the spectrum where if you're too sexy, you're like, I don't know.
Well, there's this dichotomy called the Indian and then, or the princess and the squaw in scarecrows. So this dichotomy is this idea that Native women are placed into these two categories. So the Indian princess being this Pocahontas figure where she's like sexy because she's exotic, but she like almost looks white. She's super into white guys and is going to make sure that the agenda of whatever person in question, be it John Smith or whoever, is going to, she's going to help them, basically.
Mm-hmm.
She's like assimilated. She's doesn't say controversial things, but she like knows like her songs and she's like,
yeah.
You
she's
know,
like your sexy Indian princess.
Yeah. And she's palatable. And so she's like, there's this woman without substance that's been created. And then on the far end of the other spectrum, which is this other way that women get categorized, is as this like promiscuous woman who is like, she's a prostitute or she is like, you know, this is how she's being portrayed.
Yeah, she is kind of, she, well, like, is often written about as, like, as she goes in and out of these zones of respectability. So, like, you know, maybe, how can I phrase this? You know, she goes in and out of these zones. So she's not like the Indian princess archetype where she's like, you know, she's hot, she's sexy, but she's like really down with her culture and like, you know, is there to like kind of guide white people through this like safe little Indian trail. And then on the other hand, you have and I hate saying this word, the squaw archetype, who is probably browner, like mm-hmm. walks in and out of these zones of respectability and is often in the news. You'll see her as a sex worker or an addict or something like that. And it's both of these police Indigenous women's bodies. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, with on both ends of the spectrum, Indigenous women are put into these very tight categories that you're often judged upon right away and that make you acceptable or make you palatable mm-hmm. and that don't give you autonomy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And around the narratives of rape and the narratives of sexual violence that are constantly put on Native women and their bodies then determine the level of acceptability of these things to perpetuate around Native women's bodies. And mm-hmm. and like, it's interesting having conversations around like everyday racism with people, because these things kind of become normalized. But like, when I'm out with like a group of Native women at like dancing at a club, like guys are just more like are just feel more entitled to touch your body because there's this idea about you. There are preconceived notions about me and my body that make it more okay to go about doing these things. And mm-hmm. so it's just like kind of everyday sort of experience with these things.
Yeah. And it, you know, it may not even be a conscious thing on, I'm not like getting up on my like Reddit high horse and being like, not all men.
Reddit.
But like, it may not even be a conscious thing like a dude's doing. It's just so ingrained in kind of like our mainstream conceptions about it, like Indigenous women's bodies, about brown bodies, about mm-hmm. black bodies, that like there is this barrier that doesn't exist, that mm-hmm. exists for white bodies.
Mm-hmm. And so then it comes down to this idea of the burden of representation, which a lot of women of color face. So what does it mean to be sexy or to take like a sexy photo when there are real implications? The implications of representation are lived effects. So, but like literally because of how Native women have been represented, it leads to direct violence and it leads to these things. And so what happens when you want to be able to explore your sexuality, not at the expense of others, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what does it mean, like, when Indigenous women are sexy, they have autonomy, they're presenting mm-hmm. themselves. Maybe, yeah, they want to, like, have a sexy photo out. They mm-hmm. want to present themselves in, like, a sexual way.
But without being pigeonholed.
Without being pigeonholed. Yeah. And it's totally fine. And, like... Mm-hmm. When I kind of just want to go back when you're talking like the dichotomy between like the princess and the squaw, I just wanted to be like very clear that we're not saying all Indigenous women are like this or like that exists. Yeah. Yeah, no, I just want to be very clear about that. Or that whichever way Indigenous women live their lives is their own autonomous being. Mm-hmm. And so saying that like somebody who is like in like who does like, I'm trying to think of a way to phrase this.
Well,
I'm,
what like, we're struggling. Saying is that those two categories aren't real. They're imagined by white settler colonial society to exist, because we know that within being an Indigenous woman or identified woman are the intricacies of everything and the mm-hmm. messiness of all these types of experiences. So these two categories aren't real things.
Yeah. And like, and how do you live your life? How do you date freely? How do you choose to explore your sexuality when it's constantly having these real world very hard repercussions on your community? Mm-hmm. Like, we don't need to really talk about missing and murdered Indigenous women, because we all know, like, you know, like, how do mm-hmm. you navigate those? And Indigenous gender and sexualities are mm-hmm. so regulated mm-hmm. and are so like have mm-hmm. been so oppressed by colonization that Two-Spirit folks and Indigenous queer folks, like, are erased. Mm-hmm. And their love and how queer and two-spirit Indigenous folks love and express that in community is just completely, like, either not talked about or has some very violent implications.
Mm-hmm. And again, not a simple...
No.
Not a simple one to go about. Except for all the other overarching issues that we talked about, not dating your family.
Yeah, like, so when you're like, cool, like, we're not cousins, and, like, you have status, and that's pretty chill... Here's everything else.
Yeah. Slightly smaller pool, maybe, to be going through. Who knows, though? Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah. But in thinking about the burden of representation, I was trying to figure out who we could use as an example. But there aren't a whole lot of Native women superstars on the global stage, right? Mm-hmm. So then if you think about this burden of representation from a Black perspective, from a Black feminist perspective, you have... like not the same issues, obviously, because there are different things, there are different histories informing this. But you talk about Beyonce, right? And there are a lot of Black feminists that are like, she's too promiscuous, or Rihanna, like they sell sex. And what are the implications of this on the Black community, who also Black women who also mm-hmm. experience inordinate amounts of violence? So you have Black feminists on all these different, like, saying no, she needs to be more cautious around her sexuality, and then you have people saying no, she's got the right to do her and be as sexy as she wants. It's a similar argument, right?
It's a total similar argument. I think, like, even if you look at who was actually Colleen Bull, who won
Miss Universe?
Canada?
Miss Canada?
I'm so sorry.
She won something so big, and you did
something so great, and you won something so, like, actual queen.
So big that we can't even remember if it was the whole universe or not.
Anyway, made it into the media, like, blew up in the media, as she should, because, like, she's killing it. But then she also used her position to... be very political, mm-hmm. and which is a whole other conversation, mm-hmm. You know, to like put forward issues that were happening in her community and for all Indigenous folks. And then she all of a sudden, like, was just attacked because she was up there. She's a total babe, does amazing things, won this, had media play, and everybody wanted her to be the, like, perfect Miss Pageant.
Mm-hmm.
And then she's like, hey guys, I came here
Let's
to tell
talk
some
about colonization.
I came here to tell some truths, and then, like, automatically just kind of burst out of these preconceived archetypes that would be about her as an Indigenous woman, and then just literally just laid down.
So they
truth
want
bombs.
Her. So this is an example of how these categories don't exist, because she fits this princess model, right?
Mm-hmm.
But she showed the messiness of how that isn't a thing.
Yeah.
She was like, no, actually, I'm going to sit down and talk truths with you, and you're going to be uncomfortable, but I'm going to do it because you didn't expect this, and that's great for me.
And so there's kind of, like, that idea. And I also, like, wonder, not necessarily her, but if there had been another Indigenous woman that had received that level of media attention, had she not used her position for that, or had she been, like, overtly sexual, or had, like, a little bit of a different history, how that would have been portrayed. Like, even within our own communities, there is a regulation on what it you need to be an Indigenous woman.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can argue that had she embodied different characteristics, she just simply wouldn't have got there, right?
Exactly. Or she wouldn't have won. Yeah.
But then Ashley then took on that responsibility to take her time to use that platform for the advantage of and the advancement of the discussions of different Indigenous issues.
Yeah. I don't necessarily mean Ashley. I just meant somebody who had received as much, media attention, maybe for something else. But, yeah, and then there's also, like, that idea of, like, what you have to do to be, like, a good Native woman. And nothing drives me more baddie than, like, men and Indigenous men who... like, talk about what makes a good Native woman.
Mm.
Like, do I, like, need to, like, be at home making you, like, constant bannock? Like, what the hell? Like it's so frustrating.
Yeah, so, like, just all these different things to be considered or to be considering.
There's, but, I don't know. I just saw a meme going around the other day that was, like, oh, like, a good Native woman holds up the warriors and blah, blah, blah. I'm just
womp, womp, womp.
Womp, womp, womp.
Just so you know, the Native women are the warriors, bud.
And also, there's, like, a whole other conversation to be had about indigenous men and masculinity mm-hmm. and how that plays out in dating, mm-hmm. which I'm not touching with a 10-foot pole.
That's a whole other that's a whole other discussion.
Yeah.
I think the only thing that we talked about that could have essentialized Native women in any way was that a lot of us love Patsy Cline. I think that's something most of us can agree on.
And if you don't like, I'm talking to all you Native women out there, and if you're like, I don't like Patsy Cline, you just really need to listen to Patsy Cline. Yeah. Like, you need to run yourself a bath,
yeah.
like, light a candle and lie and in weep. A tub. Like, listen to Patsy Cline and just think about all the hot people you thought were aren't your cousins and turn out to be your cousins. And then listen to Fall to Pieces.
Just weeping.
Just weeping.
Just constantly weeping little weeping. Colonial tears.
I mean,
well, before things get too fresh in here, maybe this is a good time to move on to the discussion of the big Daniels decision.
Yeah.
If you have the energy.
If you have the energy. So, conclusion on dating. There's no right or wrong way to do it. It's kind of a giant clusterfuck. And sorry
to the little children out there.
Oh, I forgot about not swearing. It is a mess. It is a big mess. A cluster mess. And that just do what you want to do that makes you happy. And I hope that everybody can find love for them in whatever way that looks.
And that you deserve love.
And that you deserve love.
And that you're sexy.
And that you're worthy of love. And that you are probably all babes listening right now.
This is also just Sam's plug to find a date for the weekend.
I am single. And ready to mingle with people who aren't Morans. So... Anyway, moving on to the Daniels decision.
So, Daniels decision. Let's hear the shortened version of some background here.
Yeah, so since I think this has been in the runnings since a long time.
That was fact checked.
That was fact checked. It was fact checked a very long time. That there was this case put forward by Henry Daniels. That was fact checked. Put forward that non-status and Métis folk should be considered Indians in the Constitution, which very much does not mean status Indian. So this decision happened outside of the Indian Act. So it really does not touch the Indian Act ever. It has to deal with a little part of the Constitution, like Section 9124 or something like that. Which is the same part of the Constitution that deals with, like, prisons and, like, weights and measurements and, like, stuff like that. So it's, like, prisons, weights and measurements, and Indians. And it was just...
That's your next book?
That is my next book.
Assuming you have a first book.
Anyway, coming back to a little bit of reality here. It's really hot in the studio. Okay. That... defines who is and is not considered an Indian and who is what is Métis, blah, 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 blah. And so you said short. And so this case basically was a landmark case that passed the Supreme Court of Canada saying that Métis and non-status folks are considered Indians, which means that we all woke up in a brand new relationship with the federal government, which is very complicated. So it means that we are now, instead of being the responsibility of provincial governments, which is how Métis governance worked before. So we had a relationship with provincial governments. That's why there's like Métis Nation of BC, of Alberta, of Manitoba, etc. Now we have a relationship with the federal government, and no one really knows what this is going to look like or what this means. But what it means is that it's opening up Métis identity again, which whenever that happens, I get a little sweaty and a little nervous. And I, like, kind of want to cry a bit. But it also is opening up what it means for Indigenous identity and what it means to be Indigenous and how our communities are regulated. And now, obviously, our identities exist outside of a colonial government. Like, I do not really care at all about the government of Canada. Or Canada.
So, oh, bum, bum.
Bum, bum, bum. Plot twist. Not a nationalist over here. So... it's this kind of double-edged sword where we receive recognition from the government and you're kind of like, cool?
We've been, yeah.
But, like, never mind. We have been self-determining, self-governing peoples for way longer than this government. So it's this double-edged sword where, like, on the short term, it could be good. Like, maybe we'll have more resources for more programming, stuff like that. But on the other hand, like, cool. Like, the colonial government just, like, looked at us again. Like, mm-hmm. Great. I don't know. It's really complicated. And in terms of, like, who is and who isn't, non-status, who is and who isn't a non-status Indian, who is and who isn't Métis, like, it's going to be so complicated. For a more finessed look at it and a little more information, I would definitely check out Chelsea Vowell has a really wonderful kind of concise article on her blog, Apitawikgosasan, and then Dr. Daniel Heath Justice, FNIS extraordinaire, did this wonderful series of tweets last night on his Twitter, which I think if you just, like, go on Twitter and just, like, search Daniel Heath Justice, it'll pop up, on what it means to be a part of Indigenous community, what Indigenous means, what Indigeneity means, because at the end of the day, what it means to be Indigenous does not exist in the colonial government. Like, mm-hmm. they will never define it. Mm-hmm. It's our relationships to each other, our relationships to the land, and our relationships to non-human things that matter. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, because it's become really messy. Mm-hmm. And it's also become like a Métis shaming event too, right? Around people getting up in arms about constituting Métis identity and pointing fingers for claiming identity. And where that comes from is an entitlement to everything that is Indigenous, starting with land, moving to bodies. It's an entitlement to everything that you are. Yeah. And so then you become nervous that you're going to get another Rachel, whatever her name was.
Dozell. And, like, what I think in terms... Sorry, did I cut you off?
Well, no. I'm just going to... All that is to say is that it's messy. But how we have the conversations of belonging are really important, that it's nuanced, because these also come from a real misunderstanding about what it means to be Métis. And there's a lot of Métis prejudice in the greater Canadian society and within the Indigenous community.
Yeah, people just don't know what Métis is. And there is just a fundamental misunderstanding of what Métis is and what it means to be Métis, because there's this, like, I'm not going to get into this conversation, but there's, like, this, like, Métis as in mixed. So, like, mixed folks who claim Métis outside of, like, a Métis nationhood. And then there's, like, Big M Métis. I'm doing scare quotes right now, or scarecrows, as Celia says, who come from, like, historical Métis nations, who are established Métis nations, who we, like, live and produce our own culture. Like, we're a nationhood. But, you know, it's a very complicated conversation. But I think a lot of people think that, like, we just, like, popped up outside of, like, First Nations communities. We have nothing to do with them. That, like, our only relationships are with, like, each other and the government, which is not true mm-hmm. at all. Mm-hmm. Like, we have historical treaties with First Nations people. Like, we have land sharing agreements. Like, we're not, I don't know, it's just so complicated. Mm-hmm. And no one wants to listen to Métis people talk. They just love having these conversations without us. And they're just like, Métis, they're just here to mess things up again.
Like, yeah, there's a lot of prejudice around Métis people in Native studies as well. Like, mm-hmm. it's just like there's a void of Métis voices.
Have had professors scared to teach Métis stuff.
Yeah.
I'm just like...
It's also, I mean, that being said, my context is on the coast, too.
Yeah, it's a little different.
So it's
here.
A little different, right?
Yeah, once you head inland into the prairies, it's quite different. But if anybody is confused what Métis is, Dr. Chris Anderson out of the U of A, who's a fantastic Métis scholar, put out this book. I'm pretty sure it's just called Métis. I would recommend picking it up. There are some holes in it, I will say that. So if anybody wants to discuss that, or if Chris Anderson's about to come after me, you can email me at sammarienaka@gmail.com. Or if you want to date. joking. Kind
but
of.
Not really.
Anyway, yeah. So the Daniels case is super complicated and really confusing. But I encourage everybody to research it, and understand that it exists out of the Indian Act. If there's one thing I will give this case, that it shows that we can have these conversations and make new legislation outside of the Indian Act, which is pretty cool, because no one wants to kick over that hornet's nest.
Mm-mm. No. So thank you for being able to fill in some of those gaps, because the other exhausting part of it is not only, I can imagine, Sam, that you're trying to move, work through the emotions and the and all of what's involved within this decision as a Métis woman, and then you're just surrounded by prejudice and people asking questions like, hold on, people, can I just look through this for a moment and just feel this for a second?
Literally the morning I woke up to the, like, everybody being like, oh, like, pass the Supreme Court, blah, blah, blah. I looked at my email. I had emails from people I don't know being like, how do you feel about this?
And I had, like, you don't know?
Because, like, well, I have a blog, right? Right. And so, like, people probably are just like, Métis, half-breed, hey, there's this blog. Let's email this girl. And then there was also, like, I had, like, Facebook messages. Like, it's insane. So if anybody wants to talk to me about the Daniels case, my going rate is about $100 a minute. And there is a tax on that if you're a settler. So we can discuss that later. I do have PayPal and accept major credit cards.
Unless you're doing it over a date.
Unless we're doing it over a date.
That changes things.
And then you just have to buy me a Caesar. And I'll give you all my opinions. And if you last to the end, well, you get to meet my aunties.
Okay, so wrapping up. I mean, I don't want to do... We had mentioned that we were also going to move into some of the representation that Attawapiskat has been receiving and attention they've been receiving in the last while. This is a conversation of a lifetime that goes back a long way. And we only have a few minutes left. So we just wanted to mention that that was something that we'd wanted to bring up.
Yeah. I mean, okay. I just want to say that our hearts are with Attawapiskat and what's happening there. And it's tragic and it's sad. And the media is banking off of it, and it's so wrong. The consumption of Indigenous trauma is so wrong. And I just, like, think if there's one thing I want folks to take away from this is that this crisis isn't only happening in Attawapiskat. Mm-mm. And it's not only suicide.
Mm-mm.
Like, this isn't the only thing that we can focus on that's, like, hurting right now. And it's hard and it's really tough, and, like, obviously our hearts are open, but I just really encourage people to be critical. Mm-hmm. When they're looking at media or they want to support, mm-hmm. just be very critical and do a lot of research.
Yeah, and like Sam said, it's not only suicide. And you mentioned that there are other really challenging things going on in the community. There are also really amazing things that come from that community that always have, right? And yeah. So, like, I would encourage you to seek out the recommendations that the Attawapiskat youth have published, mm-hmm. around what they want for healing, what healing looks like for them, and what they want in their community, and that we as a collective help to meet the needs of those youth.
Yeah, and I just want to say to any Indigenous youth that, like, the work you do is real, and everything you do is, like, is valuable. Your existence is valuable, and that all the work you put in, that people are listening, and that your labor is real, and that mm-hmm. your struggles are real,
mm-hmm.
and that I really hope that everybody has somebody supportive, or that they have venues to find somebody that is supportive.
Yeah. So without further ado, we're going to end the show on maybe not that song.
Yeah, maybe not ending on Patsy.
Too sad?
Too sad.
Okay. Well, then we're just end with the ads, I suppose.
PSAs. Thanks for listening.
Thank you so much, Haich Kasiem. Thank you again to our Musqueam hosts. Mm-hmm. Thank you for listening, and please tune in again next week to Unceded Airwaves, and enjoy your Mondays.
Yes, enjoy your Monday.
Okay.
UBC's Museum of Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of Indigenous art from around the world, and guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
AMS Food Bank. Your access to money during the studies at UBC will most likely be limited, but it is a priority of the AMS Food Bank to ensure your access to food is not. The AMS Food Bank provides emergency food relief 7 days a week for all UBC students. To volunteer with the Food Bank or for inquiries about how to take advantage of the services provided, contact them at foodbank@ams.ubc.ca. For more information, find the AMS Food Bank on Facebook or feel free to visit anytime